Welcome to Reality TV, the podcast where we cringe watch all the shows we love and love to hate. It's me, Jody, and I'm back to speak my mind and yours after an amazing two-hour episode of 90 Day Fiancé last night. We are going to need a 90 Day Fiancé network or a federally mandated withdrawal program when the season ends. But let's not even go there just yet. Let's just stay in our happy little train wreck watching bubble, and away we go. Let's begin with our lip sense loving Elizabeth and her Moldovan fiance, Andracula. Elizabeth is still about to fly to Dublin to meet up with Andracula. To quickly review for a pop quiz we would all proudly ace, they've been waiting 7 months. She's scared because she knows Andre has a serious temper at times, and she hopes he's never done anything before that would stop him from coming here. Something that might have been more helpful to bring up before you decided where you wanted to live, but hey, Elizabeth found someone who loves her despite her poor choice of lip color, and Andre benefits because he found someone who can overlook him sounding like Count Chocula with a bubble in his throat.
We will move to Moldova.
After a few weeks of only seeing his photo, we finally get to meet Andre on camera. He's a sallow-skinned 31, a bouncer in a club. He's not aggressive, but he can stand up for himself. And he also enjoys directing and starring in drunken Rocky remakes and isn't afraid to share that with producers so we can all see what a fun guy he is when he's not about to snap like Julia Roberts' husband and Sleeping with the Enemy. He's almost like a Jesse Von Trapp intensity. However, he enjoys several pints at the pub daily. Andracula describes Elizabeth as
the type of woman who can do everything, the perfect woman, and she's beautiful.
Just the type that'll make him feel like more of a man when he can stomp on her thoughts and dreams and practical ideas. With all this angst and doubt and love and fear in the air, they reunite in the airport where Andre tells her he has an interview in 2 days. I was pleasantly surprised because I thought he was going to say he got in a bar fight and his luggage was stolen, because he was wearing an odd floral print with paisley pattern blue shirt, and his jeans were riding so far up his ass when he was walking away that I had that twin thing where you feel each other's pain, and I thought maybe if I adjusted my underpinnings, maybe it would help him out. I'm a humanitarian, you guys. Now, for those of you who haven't had a chance to read up on Elizabeth, she is an actress. I think she had a part in Homeland and her mom is a talent agent or some shit, but boy, does she want us to know it in this episode. She tells us that if Andre pulls an attitude at this interview appointment, they'll say, "You're denied, get out of our face." Okay, Mickey Mouse Clubhouse 2017 editions are not actually happening, Elizabeth. You don't have to enunciate your words. Nor do I think any government employee is going to say, "Now get out of my face," unless they're working at the DMV. And even if they did, Andre doesn't give a flying fuck. His direct quote was,
"It doesn't matter. I had like a fun travel and that's it. I did break the law. I am a little bit sorry. So what's done is done."
Even Erica Jane gives more fucks than this guy. When they had that talk in the park, Elizabeth really turned me off. I don't know what kind of poor twee little me thing she likes to pull or why, but it's messed up. Because when she asks Andre what they're going to do if he gets denied, he says,
"What we'll do, we will carry on our lives here or in Moldova. We will handle it."
But Elizabeth says, My family thinks you're going to take advantage of me. You'll see when you meet them. They can be a little much sometimes.
Way to throw your family under the bus. You're the one stirring the pot, Elizabeth. That is a classic Tamra Real Housewives of Orange County move right there. And it turns out, it's not so much Elizabeth's family doubting a potential move, it's her. She said, I'll have to move to Ireland, and I have a life in America. My family's not going to be okay with that.
Okay, well, Lizzie, this is grown-up stuff. If you want to get married, do grown-up things, you have to start speaking up and acting like one.
So now we get another chance for Elizabeth to showcase her acting chops, just in case some Hollywood casting agents are watching and dying to get Elizabeth her SAG card with dental insurance so she can afford that Invisalign. Elizabeth makes Andre get up, walk out of the room, walk back in. He's got sweaty male bangs, very Jody 1988, the summer of my bus driver Dan bangs, and he can't stick to the script or commit to character, unlike our trained thespian, Elizabeth. And instead we get a scientific exploration from Dr. Andracula, PhD.
Women genetics, they have like a lot of feelings. I have confidence it will be fine.
Oh boy. So Elizabeth starts grilling him hard in her best, I'm a person who has a job voice. And we learn that Andre isn't going to kiss anyone's ass to get a visa. If they're having a bad day, he's not going along with it. He thinks they're both humans. He's not kissing anyone's ass anytime soon. Unless it's a bar bet and he's going to give someone a black eye, then go piss in the street while giving a cop the finger. You know he's that guy. Now they leave us off with the two of them arriving at the embassy, and next week we're going to find out the news. If you read any of the blogs or go on Twitter, you know how this turns out. I won't spoil it for you if you don't want to know, but if you do, go to my Twitter at RealityTVPod and you can see where I retweeted the latest update. Speaking of tweets, let's talk about someone who handles teats all day long. Molly, our bra fitter extraordinaire, and Luis. This was a tough one, guys. Luis has been in the States for only 1 week, and he's realizing Molly works a lot. I have to apologize because I've been calling Molly's daughter Kenzie, but it's Kensley. Apparently, I need subtitles for even the English spoken. I speak Chicago, so unless your twang is coming from the back of your nose and you know whether to call it pop or soda, I'm gonna have a hard time with your cutesy kid names with the extra Y's and E's and Lee's. So Kensley is training Luis to sit and roll over and fetch the margarita mix, por favor, senor, by throwing food into his mouth, or rather just in the general direction of his body. And he tells us that he has to babysit Kensley a lot. I personally think that's shitty on Molly's part for many reasons. Number one, he's a new strange man that you're leaving alone with your very young daughter. Are you fucking kidding me, Molly? I wouldn't even want to be left alone in the same room with Louise, let alone my five-year-old daughter. Not smart, inexcusable. Number two, did she find out the K-1 was cheaper than a kinder care or a summer camp at the park district? Because this would have been my last option for childcare. Number three, they don't even speak the same language. And four, neither of these two even like each other. After getting food thrown at his face like a middle schooler's worst cafeteria nightmare come true, or my dream come true if it were like little donut holes, love those. So they go outside and they start drawing with chalk on the deck. I can't even say that without my sensory issues getting triggered. That's the same as, I'm literally getting chills up my spine. Oh,
It's the same as rubbing newspaper together or like chewing on tin foil. Ugh, I can't. I thought Luis was doing the best he could by teaching Kensley some Spanish. Listen, he's trying to connect with her. He has nieces and nephews. His English is limited. And damn, if all of us parents don't know how long those days can drag when your kids are bored and you're stuck playing with chalk or reading those Disney books that have more pages than the Bible. So he's saying cute stuff like, oh, orange is naranja, blue is azul, amarillo, I am your new father. Whoa, hold up, Dominican Vader. We don't need Maury to know you are not the father. Kensley has already had a few almost dads, and she is not shy about setting her boundaries. And you know what? Maybe that's why she went outside to use that chalk, like literally drawing her boundaries so Luis backs the fuck off. Kensley tells him point blank, I already have a dad. You're not my dad. Don't make me do it again. I don't love you. The only person I love is my mom and my sister and Jess. So sorry, I don't love you. And at first I was like, damn, Kensley, easy, sassy pants. But it only took me a second to hope that my daughter would say the same thing if someone was making her say or do something she was uncomfortable with. And P.S., I also love Uncle Jesse Ebert too, girl. So Luis said it made him sad that she said that. And yes, I do feel bad for him that she was brutally honest. I've been there almost daily. My niece told me the night before I got married that I have a big nose, and my kids tease me all the time for my big boobs and my singing voice that could kill baby angels. It's called parenthood, Luis. Bienvenidos. Speaking of welcome, like a good neighbor, State Farm and Jesse is there. Jesse has set up a barbecue on the family farm. There's some incredible looking kebabs on the grill. Jesse really is a little gourmet there, isn't he? I wonder if he'd ever give Top Chef a try. I guarantee he would win fan favorite the very least. Olivia's there with her boyfriend, Matthew Hansen, the eldest son of the eldest Hansen brother. And now this barbecue is a big moment because Luis is about to meet Father Molly. Molly wears her camouflage tunic to just rub it into her dad's face. The army is not building that border wall yet. And her dad says hello to Luis, but Luis freezes up and becomes so intimidated that he doesn't utter a word for the entire rest of the meal. Now, because Luis wasn't speaking, it gave me the chance to really examine his face. He has this expression like he just smelled one of Molly's farts. So it's no wonder that I knew I was on the money when Shay Jesse places a cast iron pot on the table and calls, "You want some beans?" Father Molly takes a few bites of the beans and uses that wind it's building inside of him to power through his interrogation. Says, "Didn't you work as a bartender?" Molly answers and explains how they met and fell in love instantly. And although I could not disagree anymore with her father on his politics, I have to admit he knows his daughter. He thinks Molly is acting like a schoolgirl, that she just wants a man in her life so badly that she just makes bad decisions. And Molly says, "I hope we get your love and your support about it. I don't need it, but the hell, I'd love to have some." And her voice is just like nails on a chalkboard, right? Now, the father says, "I don't know how to respond to that right now. It's awfully early for me, and I'm old-fashioned. I have a lot of concerns about it." Gotta give it to the guy for not throwing some low blows when he could have, and he kept it honest and civil. But Molly, again, showing her immaturity, says, you know, "How's this different than meeting someone at work?" Well, even her 17-year-old teenage daughter can answer that, and she says, "It's different because you're spending more time with that person at work. You're not just meeting them twice and saying, 'Come live with me, move here to a different country.'" Mind you, Luis is still sitting there silent the whole time. Fart face already ready because Molly's digging into those beans on her plate. And we come back from commercial, they're home, and Luis has been downgraded to dog sitting now. And he asks the dog, "Wanna make pee-pee?" I have no idea why I found that scene so funny, but I said aloud to myself, "Bet you didn't think the U.S. was gonna be like this, huh?" And then he says, "When I was in Dominican Republic, I thought it would be a bit different." I'm sure you did, Louis. So he thinks it's so boring. Molly doesn't have time for him because she's working. He's lonely. He misses everything about his family. Nothing's like he's used to. He misses the city, the beach, the nightclubs, the food. These two are kind of like DeVar and Melanie from the previous season, except that Melanie went back to visit DeVar several times. Luis and Molly only know each other on vacation. It's easy to be in love on vacation. There's no kids, no bills, no work. And he's a bartender, so you're getting all your drinks comped. What's not to love? So he calls his family, they Skype in, and he's telling them as he's choking back tears that it's just a new life here with a new family. It's not that easy. His family actually seems very sweet and supportive, especially about him growing and building love for Molly's kids. I could almost see that making it harder on Luis because he just wants someone to confide in or vent to. But again, this is what he's signed up for. I'm sensing that there's going to be a major blow up. Molly seems like the type that's just going to brush over and ignore conflict. So she's just going to pretend they're happy playing house until something or someone erupts. Someone else who just wants to pretend and live in a fantasy world, let's head on over to Thailand and meet up with David and Annie. Yet again, TLC has been reading my diary because I didn't even have to wait to see David putting on a mask to hide his true persona. This mask is, of course, Wet n Wild powder foundation and a dusty rose hue blush. As always, I try to do my diligent research, and I found out way more than I'll ever need to know about Thai engagement ceremonies and traditions. But I'll tell you what, I couldn't find anything on the man wearing makeup. I think David just wanted to feel pretty on his big day too. After spending all his money at the used Buffalo lot on the cheaper sedan Buffalo with more mileage, David is afraid of being short on cash. Surprise, surprise. So of course, he's asking his friend Chris to lend him more money. Even though Chris and his pregnant wife Nikki are paying for this entire day, the wedding, and a Thai woman to marry their moocher friend, David doesn't want to keep the monks waiting. For a second, I thought he was referring to May's monkey leash, but I remembered that, fingers crossed, God willing, David's sperm are too old to swim and he's not going to be needing any child harnesses. They start this procession through the streets to Annie's house. And David looks worse than he normally does in his gauzy QVC tunics that sassy seniors buy for their cruises. He's got on white socks, pulled up to his knees on his hairless, pasty legs, geriatric white Reeboks, some kind of colostomy bag MC Hammer pants, and he's live, laugh, loving, and dancing like no one's watching down that street. Annie says he's dancing like a kangaroo, always jumping, and he kept doing some Bollywood move that I saw the contestants on The Amazing Race do a few seasons ago. And then Chris and our hero Nikki arrive. David gets stuck doing that thing where they start speaking in broken English, and he says, "My friend and wife, coming by America." God, so embarrassing. And Nikki looks like she'd rather be locked up in Guantanamo than be in this parade. But her husband, Chris, says to see where he's come from, the lowest point in his life, to leading the village like he's a king. It's incredible. Yeah, it really is, because you're the idiot paying for this whole thing. You see, David has to hand out several envelopes filled with 100 baht each to people along the way. So he's had to borrow money from Chris to just get through the day. Little conversion for you here. 100 baht is only just over $3, and he didn't even have that. David has some nerve because he says it's the best day of his life. He's feeling so welcomed and so loved. It's a big deal by Thai culture, but it's not over. The pressure is just beginning because they have more obstacles to overcome still. So guess what they're going to do? Celebrate in Bangkok, where they met. One night in Bangkok and the world's your oyster. They're dining al fresco with a beautiful view. And Annie admits to him, I have no money, no job, but I have to believe in him. Oh, Annie, he is not your daddy Warbucks. And as they're cheersing to their future, Chris and Nikki arrive to celebrate with them. Isn't that nice of David to treat Chris and Nikki to dinner and drinks by paying with their own debit card? Here we go, one of the most uncomfortable scenes in all of 90 Day Fiancé history that I can think of off the top of my head. David and Annie are going to live with Chris and Nikki because David has no car, no house, no job, no family, and no bank account because he doesn't need one because he doesn't even have $3 to his name. Cut away to Chris and Nikki, and Nikki is getting it on the record because she wants to be clear that Chris will need to own his own debt in their inevitable divorce. She is not taking that on. Nikki is a Susie Orman kind of gal, and I think Chris will get denied. Nikki interjects, let's be clear, this is not my idea at all. Chris butts in and says, I get excited, I do things without, and Nikki just finishes a sentence. Consulting with me? Oh, Nikki. Already signed up for this rental lease that she didn't agree to. Nikki's explaining that they're going to have the downstairs. I'm guessing it's like a finished basement or something. And Chris says 90 days is okay. We would like you to volunteer. This is uncomfortable even to talk about this. That he loves Thai food. I'd like to get massages. Thai massages. Would you volunteer to give me massages by the pool? I'm not making you do anything, but it would be nice. What in the holy hell? That man is disgusting. Nikki, what are you doing being married to this misogynist? And just a creep in general. I was looking at Nikki the whole time, and I think she was just too stunned, too embarrassed, too entrenched in thought as to how that fight was going to go later in their hotel room. She couldn't even say anything. And I can tell you something about poolside, beachside massages. I was on a beach in Zanzibar on a study abroad kind of thing in college. And a woman on the beach was offering massages. Well, mix hot sun, massage oil and sand into the mix, I paid for a severe exfoliation, most painful thing next to childbirth in my life. I don't know if she hated Americans and this was her way to exact revenge or just a bad business model, but either way, the backside of my body is still, 13 epidermal layers fewer than the front. So anyway, Annie asked David if he told Chris that she would do that. And he says, no, Chris embellishes. He probably got that idea because I just told him you gave me great massages. David, I don't believe you. This is how David operates. He says or does whatever he needs to do in that moment to look good or get by or get what he wants. Then he's going to lie, borrow, cheat, steal his way out of it just to stay afloat. Rinse and repeat. I am not a big fan of Annie, but I was proud of her that she told Chris no. And right after Annie declined, did you notice the tone of Chris's speech change? He said, oh, that's fine. Our goal is just to get you out on your own. Mm-hmm. And once again, our voice of reason, Nikki, says, David is basically an unwanted child, that he's got to get his shit together. He's going to get cut off.
And right to David's face, she tells him, "You're too dependent on Chris and I don't want you to be doing that anymore." David does these little puppy dog eyes, kind of like Nicole does with Azin and her family, to get what she wants. And David even says he knows it's not a good situation that they're going into, but he's going to figure it out with Annie as a team. And then he pulls that thing I hate, the Punky Brewster, Pinky Promise thing. Knock it off, grown men. Fight the urge, don't do it. Now, this money problem thing has me questioning how these two are pulling off their life in America. Because, okay, spoiler alert, skip ahead 15 seconds here if you don't want to know. They posted photos of themselves in full wedding gown and tux getting married here in the States. So who footed that bill? Chris and Nikki, or are they using their TLC paycheck to float by? I think a little cell next to Joe Giudice will be David's next rent to own. He's got that loophole scheming thing down. All right, let's go on to Josh and Ika. We haven't gotten too much of these crazy kids. Kind of dull so far, like Elizabeth and Andre, except I've been reading rumors that Ika is being compared to Anfisa. Well, Josh is on his way to pick up Ika from the Phoenix airport. And just to make the TSA agents by the departure terminal twitch, Josh is wearing pants that have more buttons, snaps, latches, holes, pockets than all of my clothes and shoes combined. This third marriage is going to be third time's a charm, because 36-year-old Ika, who he only spent 5 days with before proposing, is the woman of his dreams. And here she comes. She's a lot to take in. I hit the web and I found out that from Manila to Phoenix has 2 stops, 2 layovers, anywhere from 21 to 30 hours in flight. Taking that in your brain, Ika has on 4-inch pink heels, a super short mini skirt, a tube top with laces, 6 shades of ombre long hair, and when they were walking away, the camera was close enough to give her a pap smear, and I saw what looked like a rash in her Arizona, if you know what I mean. We got a gross breakdown of their kiss at the airport. Josh said it was yummy. Okay, another one, guys, don't use the word yummy. And Ika said, like candy, it's sticky. Really? I just saw your emerging yeast infection from a 30-hour flight, and now I gotta hear this. Stop it. Then there's some trickery, because TLC tries to tell us that they just pulled up to the house and it's the first time Josh is showing Ika. BS, they're wearing different clothes. Maybe I missed something where they said they were staying somewhere else a couple days, but I don't think so. In any event, Josh shows her around the house, shows them their room, and interesting, they're ready to go downstairs and Ika has a makeup station with makeup lights already. I smell a reshoot. Well, they go downstairs and Ika meets the roommates, who claim to be excited, probably because they're going to split the rent 4 ways, or I sure hope so. And we meet Danielle, who Josh says is a fun young woman. Okay, thanks, Dad. And then we meet Jason, who I swore was the guy from the Real World Seattle. Remember the guy? He was cute. He had a serious girlfriend. Irene kind of had a down low secret crush on him. But then I looked it up and I was thinking of the guy named Nathan. Remember him? Go back and look. They are doppelgangers. So anyway, back to Mesa. Then skeptical friend Joe shows up. Remember, he's the Patrick of Anya and Matt season. And he comes in very jovial and friendly and screams, Ika! And brings her a Welcome to America kit with flowers, chocolate, a necklace. Hello, Romeo. That's better than most men do on birthdays and anniversaries.
Joe really is a genius because somehow he manages to come across as direct but not aggressive, friendly but honest, and straightforward with his concerns of Josh moving too quickly after his life fell apart. I feel like I cannot fully trust or like Ika, and it's mainly because of those ridiculous blue contacts. And also because every time I see her on TV or in her photos online, she looks completely different. She has a shapeshifter face. But I did like what she had to say about Josh's friends needing time to get to know her, but that they have the pressure to get married in 90 days and, well, the clock is counting down. Now it's time to bring the drama, Josh and Ika. You have so much promise to be the next Jorge and Anfisa. Bring it. Well, you know, I always save the best of the worst for last, so let's dive into it. Evelyn and David. This girl, this girl. Just the sight of her face ignites such a passionate hate from people around the world. If you want to laugh, go on Twitter as the show is airing and read the comments people make. She is bringing the people of the world together like a Coca-Cola commercial, but it's not with her Christian music and her sparkling personality. So we dive into their segment with the whole family getting ready for the big welcome party. Mother Evelyn has made a chocolate cake and David asks, "Oh, can I stick my finger in it?" And then Evelyn says, "Ew, don't say it like that. It sounds so gross." Okay, Evelyn, you're the only one daydreaming about his fingers, you pervert. Go sing a prayer about it. Well, my building hatred balloon suddenly burst when a magnificent creature appeared before my eyes. Yep, Aunt Ginger. Well, Aunt Ginger is just as sweet as can be, with a heart as big as Evelyn's ego, and she thinks the happy couple is very good on the eyes. He gave me a hug right away, which I thought was very personal. He's going to be a great addition to the family. Hey, get ready for this one. Brace yourself, because this might become a movie one day. TM, I'm registering it. Trademark, Jody. The ultimate dream team. Sister Bev of Melanie and DeVar. Sandusky Beth, Danielle's friend. And Aunt Ginger. Just three ladies out on the town looking to knock some skulls and or boots. Okay, back to the party of dying dreams. David is being introduced to everyone. Pastor Tim and Julie, more friends and family. And David's feeling a little intimidated coming into such a close family. But they're trying to engage him, asking where they're going to live as a married couple. And David starts talking about wanting to move south to the Virginia where it's a little warmer. And Evelyn starts squirming, like she wants to make it perfectly clear that Evelyn doesn't like ye, and like pouting her little face. So the producers pull Hot Jesus and her mom outside, and they are not thrilled with this idea of Evelyn moving. And you know what? That's why you just don't throw your support at your immature, barely 18-year-old daughter to make decisions like getting married. And you know what else I can't support? The spelling of her parents' names. Did they rename themselves in some kind of biblical manner? Because their names are so strange. And what are the chances of two people with weird spelling names ending up together? Her mom's name is Jacqueline, spelled J-A-C-A-L-Y-N, Jacqueline. And Hot Jesus's name is Mikaia, spelled M-I-C-A-I-A-H. What the fuck? Back in the studio, I mean family room, Evelyn and David are asked what will happen to the band. Evelyn is the band. Oh, fuck off, family. She is not that talented. And last time I checked, she isn't topping any Billboard charts. Do you think David even gives a shit about her music career? He doesn't ask about it. He doesn't seem too concerned. You think he knows that she sucks and he's just hoping that if they move, she'll pack up her guitar for good? Evelyn's hopeful that David's going to change his mind so she can stay living at home and have her mommy make her one egg every morning, and that he's going to find that he loves the blistering, long, cold, snowy winters of the Northeast. Ding dong! Michaela's here. The entire room goes silent as Michaela walks in. There's this super awkward, "Hello, Michaela." "Hello, David." Very Seinfeld, "Hello, Newman." They really waste no time in teaming up on Michaela. Michaela tries to be civil and explain how she thinks an 8.5 year age gap is substantial when Evelyn's only 18. Then Evelyn, such a sweet best friend who insisted Michaela come, asks, "Did you just come to size him up?" Jesus Christ, Evelyn, you are such a bitch. Can we change Jesus Christ, Evelyn, to just fuck off, Evelyn? Brother Solomon tries to make peace, as a family band bassist naturally does, and says that maybe they'll get to know one another eventually and become friends later. And then I start to see why David is just as bad as Evelyn. He says, "So far, I felt welcomed by everyone but you. Are you dating someone? You sound like someone who is not dating." You asshole. You're 26 years old. You're a pathetic, grown man who's trying to make a teenager feel bad that she's not dating someone. These two deserve each other, and I hope they have a miserable little existence where they try to outshine each other until they have kids and the kids just suck the life out of them. But then they're probably going to dump their kids off with Hot Jesus and Jacqueline so they can go eat donuts and talk about fun facts why they hate each other. Poor Michaela is left with no one in that room to defend her, and she's crying, holding back tears as she chokes out. She wishes them a lot of happiness. And then David quietly says, not sure if everyone heard it, "I hope you have a good desire for someone else." Fuck off, David. His smugness is infuriating. Later, Evelyn tells us that she's really disappointed with how the welcome party came out. Real nice. People went through a lot of time in preparation for this little party for you, took time out of their days to come over and kiss your ass, but you're not happy. Care to bet that she never called to see how Michaela was feeling? So they're going to sit down and do wedding invites together. But first, Evelyn needs to explain what invitations are and that she's a planner and she likes things a certain way. "So you mean you just always want things your way? Just say that, Evelyn." Literally two letters on the piece of paper, and she barks, "Are you writing in cursive?" You know what? No one gives a shit what your wedding envelope looks like. We've been looking at your shitty haircut and attitude for weeks, so I'm pretty sure people can deal with a Danilian print. But the print style really isn't the root cause for these two. It's that they've never had to disagree on anything, so they don't even know how to solve a conflict with each other, which is why it's important not to rush marriage, because you're always going to have conflicts to solve together. You see, David has friends and family flying in for the wedding, so he expects her friends and family to host his friends and family. Yeesh, this is a tough one. Some of them are not going to be able to come if they don't have accommodations set and paid for already because they can't afford hotels. So this truly is a tricky one, because I can see how asking friends and acquaintances to host strangers is a large request and pretty odd. However, expecting people to throw thousands of dollars to stay at hotels nearby is a lot to ask, so you can have your little dream wedding. Evelyn has no concept of money or spending because mommy and daddy still pay for everything and she doesn't have a job. But David, assuming everyone is just going to become host families no matter what, I don't know, maybe this is something they should have planned for months ago. So David is literally sick and tired and says, "I'm feeling sick and tired." Same Z's, same as all of us watching you two assholes. And Evelyn just throws in, "Is that your easy out?" Oh, I don't think anyone has an easy out with Evelyn. She's the kind of girl with an acute long-term memory. Always a good Christian girl, Evelyn assures us that they'll still be on bad terms tomorrow morning, too. Hey, or you could try to compromise and meet him in the middle somewhere. This is going to be a very unhappy marriage. She is a classic narcissist, and so is he. They will never emotionally fulfill each other as much as they emotionally fulfill themselves. Little Allison Dubois for you there. And stick around, speaking of Allison, because we're going to talk about her later. But first and lastly, Nicole and Azen. What will it take to get this girl to strap on a GoPro 24/7? I could hate watch her all freaking day. We pick up with them in Casablanca before heading to Agadir, which is Azen's hometown. Azen didn't take Nicole out much last time. He's promised to take her out more. However, I specifically remember them going out last time. Remember they were in the market where she asked if she could kiss his shoulder, and they went to that sand dune where she almost died? I call BS on that. Or I don't blame him, because I would be afraid to take Nicole out in public, even to my local Aldi. Can you imagine how that quarter cart system would blow her mind and stump her for hours? Back to Casablanca. Azen wants to show them the mosque because it's important for him to show May his Muslim culture, and that if they have kids in the future, he would like them to be Muslim, but he wants them to just choose what's going to make them happy. I actually got to give it to him, because that's a really great attitude to have towards your own religion and towards your kids' religious choices. They stop in Marrakesh at a market. I think Nicole was kind of mad she didn't get a free cookie like May did, because she stood a little too long at that vendor, like waiting for her turn. Move along, it's not feeding time yet, Nicole. As they're walking through the market and courtyard, Azen senses people are looking at him and judging because he has May on her monkey leash. Why is Azen the one in charge of the leash anyway? Is Nicole really that lazy? Or does he not trust Nicole with May either? Or maybe is Azen a little too into May? Azen says that my mom would slap me in the face if she saw me with May on a leash. I want to slap him in the face for continuing to wear those deep V shirts and the Mr. Rogers sweater. That burgundy one looks like something that is sold at Ann Taylor. We get treated to the three of them in the back seat. It was a tight squeeze. May had on her perma headphones and iPad again. She's not going to have attention issues at school or anything. And Azen says he's starting to feel like a father. Nope, nope, nope. I don't like this. This playing house thing with a young kid being the toy. You are not a family. They're going to leave. You're going to be in Morocco, and this little girl is going to have this pseudo play dad that's being forced into her life. While Azen is focusing on pretending to be a dad, Nicole is getting resentful because they aren't getting any alone time. Because of course she is. She really wants Azen to ask his aunt if they can share a room at her house. She knows it's not acceptable in public, but she's read that it's okay in private homes. All right, I spent some time this morning going deep, and I could not find evidence of what Nicole said. Try it yourself. Go online, Google unmarried couples in Morocco. Everything you read says that if one of the people in the relationship is Moroccan, a hotel or a riad will not allow you to share a room. Private hoteliers and even the public can be fined and get into some hot water because it's against the law. If both people are from anywhere other than Morocco, so an American unmarried couple goes and stays there, they're not going to question you. But if one of you is Moroccan, at least one of you, absolutely not. So it makes sense that Azen is super nervous about asking his aunt. I would be nervous asking my family too. But then again, we have Nicole, who has no problem asking her family to do everything, so she cannot comprehend social etiquette or the law. Back from a commercial break and a refill on my latest favorite wine, a nice Pinot Gris from Cooper's Hawk. Ooh, look at me, fancy. And it's day 13 and they've made it to Azin's hometown. They're heading up what could be the inside of Nicole's gut. Bubble gum, goopy pink paint covering all the walls, like she just drank some strawberry flavored milk because she won't drink white milk. You know she was that kid, and she's that adult that still mixes in strawberry high fructose syrup in because it's yummy in my tum tum. The fact that Nicole had to climb to the top floor was not lost on me. Oh, karma, we meet again. The door swings open, and it's a scene from Not Without My Daughter or Taken. The aunts and the mom swoop up little May and her monkey, and they're kissing her, loving on her. I get it. It was meant out of love and very sweet of them. But call me protective. I don't want people I don't know all too well being that affectionate with my kid. Not that I think they meant any harm at all, but let's just ease into the kisses and the hair braiding. Okay, so this scene, we've got to get to the bottom of this. What is the end goal with these two? What's the long con? Or is there one? Azin clearly doesn't like Nicole. He's actually hesitant to go to the U.S. with her. But he dotes on May, and his family seems genuine in talking with Nicole. Or maybe I'm just gullible and they see a use for her. I can't process what's going on. Azin's mom shares that she's going to miss Azin, but she knows that he's going to be okay in the U.S. and that if Nicole ever has a problem with him, if he's acting up, she should just call him. They even recite the sweet proverb about taking care of May as if she were his own. And in this moment of bonding and acceptance, Nicole sees the perfect opportunity to just destroy it and burn it all down. And she nudges Azin and wants him to ask in front of everyone if they can share a room. Are you really that stupid, Nicole? Or are you just that horny? What a moron. With no choice left, Azin reluctantly says, Nicole is asking if we can share a room. You could feel the air getting sucked out of that room through the TV screen. And not for nothing, Nicole has some balls and absolutely no shame. So now we get to the scene we've been building up to for weeks. Azin is taking May and Nicole out to lunch. He's trying to save May from being run over by a car. Again, Nicole oblivious, letting Azin be Mr. Mom. And he says, this way, May, look. And then little May says, don't touch me. Oh, girl. For a 2 or 3 year old to say that? No, ma'am. No one speaks like that around my house. Nicole, start parenting your kid and teaching her some manners. So they sit down to eat, headphones and iPad already on May's head. And Nicole is going to order the chicken sandwich, no vegetables, because she doesn't like veggies in her tummy. Grow the hell up. You're in Morocco and you're ordering a meal from Chili's, basically. The conversation already started off tense with Nicole's refusal to eat any sort of vitamin, nutrition, or leafy green. And then Azin admits that he's nervous about moving to the U.S. because Nicole's dad has stipulated that they cannot live together. It's interesting that Azin is annoyed by this because it's the same thing that he's asking Nicole to do in his country. He's worried about living separate because he's going to be in a house all alone. He doesn't know anyone. He doesn't speak the language perfectly. She can go out and see friends, and that he's going to have to keep tabs on her because of that little cheating issue last year. We just learned now that he was done with her back then, but that she turned into a bunny boiler and she kept calling him 100 times. So he finally caved and took her back. Big mistake. Huge. Then there was an incident a few months ago. She took off her ring and she went out with her friends. She just wanted to be free for a night. That's all. Again, he's not that into her, but he's so jealous. like he is into her? I don't understand. So if you closely watch this scene, she asks, "Do you love me?" And he says, "I do love you," but he nods his head no as he's saying it. Body language experts, get on this. Now they start arguing in the middle of the restaurant, which is embarrassing enough. And Nicole's now flustered because she's annoyed that Azen doesn't trust her. And she says, "I asked my dad to financially support you for 10 years. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Not what he is doing, Nicole. He is not financially supporting him for 10 years. He's co-signing that he'll keep tabs and sponsor him for 10 years. Someone please set this straight. Father Nicole, you in danger, girl. Back in the interview room, a producer is trying to make sense of what this fight is all about. So they break the fourth wall and they say, "Nicole, who did you go out with that night?" And she answers, "Just a guy friend of mine." And Azen's eyes bugged out bigger than Nicole's did when she saw that cookie cart in Marrakesh. And he says, "A guy, you said girls, so why did you lie about it?" And Nicole does her best to try and lie and manipulate and twist and whine and pout her way out of it. So when that doesn't work, she throws a temper tantrum and ends the interview. Azen says that if he would have known that she went out with a guy then, he absolutely would not have asked her to come to Morocco. So he leaves, takes a breather outside, and Nicole follows him out to try to talk to him. They come back in, he's refusing to speak, he's not going to leave with her, and she's got some white shit on her sweater, which I hope it's permanent white paint because I hate her. But I like to think that it's powdered sugar that she carries with her in like a Dora the Explorer backpack. And when she gets grumpy or tired from walking, she just digs in there. So her belly makes her heart smile again, just shoves the powdered sugar in her mouth. Now, Nicole's back at the hotel, calls her mom, which her mom would probably give her some pretty sound advice. But since Nicole is not going to admit any fault or that anything's wrong, she doesn't say anything. Azen agrees to meet with Nicole the next day to talk, and I'm just worried about which bike rack Nicole is chained May's leash up to. And they're going to talk about where they stand. Because Azen can't trust her, he doesn't want to go to the U.S. and find out she's been lying and hiding stuff. Spoiler alert, I have no actual spoilers, but I can promise you that she's hiding stuff. And it's not just donut holes under her bed. Nicole pleads and swears that this guy was just a friend, but no matter, he only trusts her 40%. She wears him down enough that he caves and he says that he's going to try to trust her to move forward, but she's going to have to prove it. I got a bad feeling when they talked to Nicole privately and she said to the camera, making no eye contact, and she's swaying side to side, and she says, "If it ends, it'll be on me because I did something I shouldn't have." So she totally boned the guy front, didn't she? We get a passionate, "I love you. I really love you," from Nicole, and a typical hesitant, "I know, I love you too," with no eye contact from Azen. Next week, Azen says something about Nicole sending him $800, $500. This is going to get good. Her mom is going to be livid if she's living in what's likely government housing motels with May while she's sending over money to Azen for cardigan sweaters and pomade. Next up, just a little pondering about Maura Murray. So I've been watching the Oxygen 6-part series on Maura Murray. I was not fully convinced she was murdered until this last final episode, episode 6. Alison Dubois of the TV show Medium Fame and friend of Camille Grammer and Real Housewives of Beverly Hills shows up on the scene. I gotta tell ya, a sober Alison Dubois out in the field is pretty damn convincing. I'm not fully convinced she didn't research at least a little bit before she flew out there to meet and record a documentary, but I was buying it nonetheless. She has an interesting affect, which takes a little getting used to, but it's fascinating. What gave me the chills and what made me buy into what she was saying was when she was asked whether Maura is alive or not. And she asked very honestly, and it almost sounded like she was asking off the record, how is the family going to be seeing this? Because she's convinced Maura died very shortly after she was taken. Now, for those of you who haven't seen it, Allison believes Maura went willingly, albeit a little hesitant, with an acquaintance she knew through other people. It was probably sort of a date rape thing gone wrong, was her sense, and that this guy then called two friends, possibly brothers, and they helped hide her body. She thinks the body is going to be found just outside the original search perimeter, near a bridge, in a local kind of hangout. Also, Allison is convinced that Maura's friends are the key to solve this case and that it will be solved, but they just haven't put the pieces together yet. Now, because the person who did this is a sociopath, a killer hiding behind a smile and a nice guy persona, Maura is not the first or the last of his victims. If you haven't watched the series, I encourage you to go back and watch it. I really haven't ruined anything for you. It's a really good weekend binge watch. And the only thing is now I need to find another good docuseries. So throw them at me if you have some ideas. As always, thanks so much for listening today. I'll be back later this week with some more reality TV trash talking. Join the cool kids over on Instagram and Facebook. Welcome to Reality TV. Twitter at Reality TV Pod. And thank you so much for spreading the word and subscribing. I'm having so much fun talking to you all. Talk to you later. Have a great Monday and a great week ahead. Bye.